This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Kieran, I'm sure our listeners will be delighted to know that we haven't got time for me to moan about the fact it's still daylight at 7:30 in the evening. Plus, it's also pouring with rain, so I'm quite happy. Kieran, the news, as we just said the other day, the news just keeps on coming, doesn't it, these days?
It's non-stop. We've had to go and rewrite the script. And my big fear is that when we finish recording on a Sunday, I'm thinking, we've got nothing for Thursday's show. me of little faith. Yeah. The industry never lets us down.
Yeah. I've just written down the words rewrite the script, ? Smiley face emoji. First of all, Kieran, I was astonished yesterday to see there was a parliamentary committee going ahead that you didn't seem to be part of. I'm fairly certain that even the Boris Johnson inquiry last week, you were sitting just behind Michael Fabregan in case a football finance inquiry came up during the middle of it. But yes, so you weren't there, but the head of the Premier League was there and he didn't look too happy about it, did he?
Yes, so this is the sort of the oral evidence committee following the publication of the white paper. And if anybody wants a full transcript, go to the government website. It is all there in its full glory. So we had Kevin Miles from the Football Supporters Association, Tracy Crouch, Debbie Hewitt, who's the new head of the FA, Rick Parry from the EFL, and Richard Masters. And it has to be said that I think the first four conducted themselves very well, got their messages across. Tracy intimated that the Premier League hadn't always been as helpful as perhaps people would have liked. So the committee picked up on this, and when Richard Masters came to the table, I think it's fair to say he was lightly barbecued. Mm. So they asked him, had the Premier League tried to kick the white paper or the fan-led review into the long grass? And he looked surprised and said, well, no, I don't know where you got that from. And they said, well, Tracy suggested it about 10 minutes ago. And he goes, oh, well, I don't recall it like that. Mm. But to be fair, the members of Parliament who were forming the committee stuck to their guns and gave him a pretty hard time. He effectively said that the Premier League weren't happy about it, but they didn't have any choice. And he also, I think he's got a bit of an own goal by saying, well, you know, when the Truss government was in charge, it wasn't going to go ahead. And everybody sort of went, we try not to remember the Truss government. I wouldn't bring that up. It's a bit like a racist uncle at a wedding. Everybody tries to pretend that it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
So there has been some progress, it would appear, between the Premier League and the EFL with regards to a change in the financial distribution of monies. But the sticking point, and this didn't necessarily come from what we heard yesterday, but it certainly appeared in other publications, the sticking point appears to be in relation to parachute payments. The EFL are quite adamant that they should be abolished, and the Premier League's going, it makes the Premier League better. And in my view, they've got a point. I still think that they're too long. I still think that they're too high. So I think there is progress to be made. And also, it's a bit hypocritical of the EFL to be opposed to parachute payments when the EFL have parachute payments themselves. So I think the EFL aren't exactly looking too far inwardly there. But there was broad agreement. I think it was interesting listening to what was said by Debbie Hewitt in respect of grassroots football. And you know, from my perspective, I'm thinking, well hold on. Yeah, grassroots football is a much broader issue. This is to do with central and local government funding of parks and public places and school funding as well. And whilst I think that the Premier League doesn't help itself at times to effectively say that 20 ultimately quite small companies should be responsible for the funding of grassroots sport and the benefits that that brings in terms of health, community, and so on. I think that's a slightly more political issue. Kevin Miles was absolutely brilliant, as he always is, and we'll have to get Kevin on the show
because
he's always he's extremely well briefed, very funny, and is quite good at skewering those people who are, shall we say, on the wrong uns list of football. So that's where we left it. Richard Masters, by the end, was. Yeah, having a look of a bloke who's at a party who's accidentally followed through. He had that face of just slightly just wishing he wasn't there.
Yeah. We should also get Kevin Miles on because he's got a wonderful broadcasting voice. It's always a pleasure to hear Kevin Miles. It didn't help a bit later on that Richard Masters was, I wouldn't say ambushed, but it seemed that he was confronted with the notion that the Newcastle story hasn't gone away as much as he thought it might have done in terms of who actually owns the club.
Yes. So he was asked by one of the committee, could you confirm that you are not investigating the ownership issues of Newcastle United?
Yep.
To which his reply was, I can neither confirm nor deny. And you go, well, it's quite a simple question, Richard. Mm. He says, well, we only ever go and confirm things when we reach a final decision. And I'm going, and other people are going, well, hold on. Manchester City said in their accounts 6 months ago that they were being investigated by the Premier League.
Yeah.
And the Premier League effectively agreed with this. So you can't have it both ways. So there has been an issue in the United States with regards to the Saudi Arabian public investment fund and the Live Golf symposium or emporium, whatever you want to call it. And there, the Saudi Arabian government has said it can't be investigated by a US court because it's effectively part of a sovereign government and therefore the US has no jurisdiction over the activities of PIF. And if that's their viewpoint, that's perfectly entitled to it. How does it impact upon Newcastle? Well, Newcastle have been told and the Premier League have been told that PIF is not directed by the Saudi Arabian government. So it's a bit messy. I suspect there are things taking place. I suspect Newcastle will be firing up that the equivalent of the bat light over Gotham City with a Nick DeMarco shaped beam into the clouds to try to address this. So we await with interest as always. And yes, it was a tough time for Richard Masters. You know, I wouldn't have been wanted to be. And he kept making reference to unintended consequences, and unintended consequences has become one of these new buzz phrases of, oh, well, yeah, there could be something lurking in the shadows. We don't want the politicians to take control of this. My understanding, if I'm talking to one or two politicians, is that they want to get nowhere near this because they can just see it could be, you know, an absolute car crash in terms of being linked to any one political party, the next football club that goes bust. And whether we have a regulator or not, it might reduce, and ideally it will reduce the chances of a football club going bust, but it can't guarantee it, just as though, you know, increasing police numbers can't guarantee that all crime will disappear. So politicians don't want to get involved with this, but Richard Masters was sort of playing the bogeyman charge, and we are also seeing this from some of the more libertarian commentators with regards to football.
I suppose to continue your colourful analogy about Richard Masters at the end of a party having followed through, that would be also an unintended consequence as well, wouldn't it?
Yes.
And also I think we should point out that Newcastle may not approach Nick DeMarco, because I believe in these circumstances it's what the legal profession calls first cab off the rank. It's just, I suspect Nick might be the first cab off the rank in this situation. We've been talking, Kieran, a lot about the streaming of EFL games recently, and now there's a potential new player on the block when it comes to broadcasting games outside the Premier League.
Yes, this is in respect of the EFL deal, which is presently with Sky, and it's worth £119 million a year. And it looks as if the broadcaster DAZN wants to buy the rights to every single EFL match, and therefore that would include those matches which kick off at 3 o'clock on a Saturday, which would mean the current rules with regards to the blackout disappearing. So, yeah, the first person you think about this is our friend Andy Holt, and to be fair to Andy, he says we need more information. But yeah, we've got to weigh up the pros and cons of this. If it means an extra £100 million coming into the EFL, then we've got to see, you know, and the EFL talks about, well, the Premier League's not very good at distributing money. I've got to be honest, the EFL itself is not very good at distributing money between the EFL, because 80% of it goes to the clubs in the Championship. And therefore, a club like Accrington Stanley, which is in League One, just gets 12%. And if Accrington get relegated and, you know, they're not having the greatest of seasons, that drops to 8%. So they get 1/10 of the broadcast money that the clubs in the Championship are entitled to receive. So, as always, the devil will be in the detail. Andy is not necessarily the Luddite that some people paint him to be. What he wants is, if this money is going to come in, how is it going to be distributed between the home team and the away team? And for a club like Accrington, which can get up to 30% of its matchday income from away fans, you can understand why he wants to protect his position. Equally, you can understand why those bigger clubs, and we know who the bigger clubs are with the big support, why they say, well, yeah, we've got the fan base, so surely we should have more of the money. It's that trade-off between establishment and trying to get some attempt of distribution, which ensures a greater degree of competitive balance. So DAZN are interested. Sky, I would imagine, will be quite keen to protect what they have, because they've got a good relationship with the EFL. We've also heard about the Scandinavian group, which is called Viaplay. They're supposed to be interested. Well, and this is all fantastic news from the EFL, because the more people you've got interested, the more you can bid up the numbers. So if we go from £119 million a year, there's talk of that going up by, you know, the best part of £100 million. That's more money to distribute between the 72 clubs. And then, of course, it comes down to the detail of, okay, we've got a bigger pie, how do we slice it?
DAZN, that's how they're pronouncing, is it? DAZN.
That's right. Yeah, I'm with the kids, Kevin.
You are.
With the kids.
Well, it might help if they put the O and the E in there. I mean, they're playing very cavalier where they put one vowel in and forget the... if that's how they want to pronounce it, it's entirely up to them, Kieran. We have yet to reach a stage where things are decided by what we say on the pod, unfortunately. Some better news, Kieran, for playing staff at Wigan Athletic this week.
Yes, player wages have been paid. The players have come out with a very strongly worded statement,
indeed,
to say that they have received inaccurate information from the club historically over the course of the season. They're professional footballers. They want to play football. They've got to be treated like professionals. The Wigan chairman, Talal al-Hamad, has said, this will not happen again. And then he says, I have said that before, haven't I? So probably not helping his case. But it looks as if there could be some form of new charges by the EFL. And I've not read the document. I've been reading lots of documents. But the EFL has said, and again, fair play to them, they want Wigan to put 125% of the expected wage bill each month into an account well before the wages are paid, and the EFL will make sure that that money goes in. Well, I don't think that's happened. Right. And therefore, Wigan could be subject to further charges if they don't adhere to this request over the forthcoming months. So that's not good. You know, Wigan are not in a great position in the table. The 3 points deduction that they have had has certainly made it more challenging for their attempts to stay in the Championship and the financial benefits that that brings.
See, this is where I wish we could put a bat signal up to get Nick DeMarco on the phone, because I'd be interested in the legal status of a request from the EFL to do that. Is that within the EFL's remit to ask them to do it? And if they request it, surely the club can politely decline that, can they?
Well, if it's part of an agreed settlement in respect of a business plan, which I suspect it is, with the alternative of, right, we're going to give you further charges because of the number of times that you failed to pay wages. And again, what the EFL doesn't want to do is to have lots and lots of points deductions, but we've got one for Wigan. Potentially, we could be having one for Reading, although that story seems to have dried up, which is, you know, potentially good news for Reading itself. Relegation and promotion and playoffs should be determined by what happens on the pitch, and rather than the conclusions of an individual panel or commission. But at the same time, financial deterrence in respect of owners don't seem to work. Finger wagging doesn't seem to work. So what are the alternatives that are left for the regulatory bodies?
So it's better news for Wigan's playing staff, Kieran, but unfortunately it's a pattern being repeated not far down the road, isn't it?
Yes. And again, this is a club that appears too often on The Price of Football. We've always said, you know, once every 6 months, that's great. You know, we'll have a chat. You'll have done something new, you know, new sponsors. Yeah, we'll have a bit of a natter about it. But Morecambe FC have been fairly regular. Yeah. Topics. And this is in respect of the March wages, where one of the co-owners said that they may be late. And you go, well, they're either going to be late or they're not going to be late. So, yeah, what on earth's going on here? But the owners are trying to sell the club, and we have spoken before about the prospective new owner, who is a 20-year-old soft drinks mogul from Solihull. And I read that and I instantly think Bucktooth Girl from Luxembourg. I don't know about you, Kevin, but that hit me. And that takeover is proceeding very slowly. So therefore, if the owners had hoped to have sold the club by now, they have failed to do so. They say therefore that's given them a liquidity challenge. But then this morning, and this came through on my company's house feed at 01:24, which you can imagine how pleased the Baroness was when that happened. The parent company, which is Bond Group, they are subject to a winding up order in respect of non-publication of their accounts. And what the parent company has also done is they have invoked Companies Act 2006, Section 442, which is my favourite section number because it's 442. But it does say that if you change your financial year end by one day, it allows you to delay publishing your accounts for 3 months. So Morecambe should have published their accounts by the end of March, and now they've got another 3 months' grace. It's poorly drafted legislation, in my view, because it has been taken advantage of by some owners of big organisations. I'll mention no names, but might involve a former owner of Newcastle United, for example. And therefore, we don't know the extent of Morecambe's finances, which is disappointing. If owners want to say something to the media, that's great, but there has to be a greater emphasis on being upfront and being transparent and not hiding behind poorly drafted legislation to avoid disclosing the state of the club's finances.
Mm. You know, when you get your notifications from Companies House, is there a special ting Is there a sound effect that Gail goes, oh, bloody company's house again? Have you thought about maybe getting a burner phone to get your messages from company's house on? And also, Kieran, I have to say, in the 2 minutes that you gave me, I'm afraid that reference part of the Bucktooth girl from Luxembourg. I can't remember whether that's up there with the Russian Mafia sisters, or I'm guessing it's some kind of early 80s pop reference. Is it, Kieran?
It is. It's Ask by the Smiths.
Ah. Oh, blimey. I'm going to get in trouble with Ali for that. Crikey. Well, well done. If anybody had that in their sweep, congratulations. They're definitely the winner of this week's ITV7's gone out of the window, apart from the person who had Bucktooth girl from Luxembourg. Surprising news coming out of Tottenham this week, Kieran, in the same way that seeing a bear going into a forest with a copy of the Sunday paper and a toilet roll under his arm would be surprising. I don't know why they've done it, Kieran. Clearly, they're upset about something. But Antonio Conte I was going to say left Spurs by mutual agreement, but he hasn't really, has he? He's been sacked. How much is that going to cost them?
Well, you know, the beauty is in the fine print of his contract of employment. There was a £24.1 million settlement in Chelsea's accounts in 2021, which was superbly and vaguely referenced as a legal dispute, which has now been settled. And everybody knows that Conte, when he was sacked by Roman Abramovich, says, nobody sacks me, and gets away with it scot-free. Mm. So it looks as if Antonio Conte was well compensated for being sacked by Spurs, sacked by Chelsea. Now, in relation to his position at Spurs, it is estimated that his contract, which was due to expire on the 30th June, would cost Spurs somewhere in the region of £4 million for the last 3 months or so of the financial year. There is uncertainty, however, if Spurs qualify for next year's Champions League, because this might invoke a clause which some journalists are saying could be worth up to £15 million. Now, presently, Spurs are in fourth position, if I recall correctly, although Newcastle have games in hand, as do Brighton, has to be said.
It doesn't have to be said, Kieran, but you know, it was very much optional, that one, Kieran, but yeah, fair enough, crack on.
So where that stands from a legal point, we'll have to wait until the end of the season. If Spurs are still fourth, will Mr. Conte be advising his legal representatives to say, well, I contributed towards that fourth place finish and the financial benefits that brings to Spurs, so where do we stand with regards to that? So, yeah, he won't go short regardless of all this. And what I would say to Spurs is, if they're thinking of recruiting a new manager, probably not a good idea to go for a volatile Italian.
Oh, well, your manager's quite good, Kieran. Maybe they could look just down the road. That's worked for Chelsea, isn't it?
Yeah, but he's Italian and volatile, our manager.
Okay. Is he volatile? I don't know much about him, Kieran, surprisingly.
He's been red carded. He's been banned twice already. He's had four yellow cards and one red card from... and we love it. You can imagine as fans, he's goes absolutely disco at the referees.
Well, and also at the wine waiter as well, I imagine, if the Pinot Grigio turns up less than properly chilled. Talking of Chelsea, Kieran, you've mentioned a few times in the last couple of weeks that the Premier League have entered into what we can only call a hold my pint phase. And suddenly, from being quite like an elderly lion in a tree for the last couple of years, they really have sprung into action for some reason. We don't know why that might be, but their latest spat is with Chelsea.
Well, this could be a bit of 2 and 2 = 5 in some of the newspapers, okay. But Chelsea did publish, and this is something that I particularly loathe, they published on their website effectively a one-pager saying, these are the financial results. And gave a sort of a dotted history as to, or potted history, shall I say, as to what has happened over the course of the season 21-22. The long and the short of it is that Chelsea lost £121 million. And therefore, some commentators have said this could result in the club being close to a breach of financial fair play rules. I got out the trusty spreadsheet, and I think Chelsea are actually quite well within the Premier League limit. I'm not necessarily so certain that they are within the UEFA limits for financial fair play, which is €30 million. Now, it could be that Chelsea finish 10th this season and therefore don't play in Europe next season, and therefore it becomes a non-issue. But they have lost a lot of money in recent years. They do have a lot of inventory, and it's a horrible word to say, but, you know, because we're talking about young men, but they do have Mason Mount, Conor Gallagher, Ruben Loftus-Cheek, Callum Hudson-Odoi, all players who have come from the academy. So therefore, anything they sell those players for is pure profit from an FFP perspective. So I don't see it as being a bit of a huge issue, but there will be complications if they do breach the rules or potentially breach the rules. And then where do we stand with regards to the government's decision to freeze Chelsea's assets in March 2022? Because Chelsea weren't allowed to sell merchandise. They weren't allowed to sell match day tickets. They say that they lost some players because they weren't able to negotiate with those players whose contracts expired at the 30th of June. And therefore, you know, I think Christensen left, some other players left, Rudiger left. And yeah, they say, well, you know, they might have stayed, in which case they wouldn't have cost us anything. And we've had to go out and spend, you know, more than God in over the course of the last transfer windows, and that was all due to that nasty UK government freezing the assets of our fragrant Russian owner and chum of Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, we have talked about this issue before, Kieran, the whole petty cash God thing, yes, and how he probably doesn't need to be tied down to financial. There was one journalist in particular who seemed to be quite buzzy, shall we say, about the Rudiger transfer being not dodgy or suspect, but being under investigation. But also a couple of journalists off the back of this story have suggested that, as you say, it was around this time last year that their assets were frozen, but also suggesting that by then Chelsea had banked most of the income from that season anyway, so it wasn't perhaps as big a financial problem for Chelsea as it was made out to be at the time.
I agree with you entirely. The broadcast money, that's completely independent of the assets being frozen. Chelsea had already sold season tickets, and they've got, you know, at least 27,000 season tickets. Many of the tickets for individual matches are sold way in advance of the matches taking place. So it tends to be away tickets. Yes, they would have lost a bit of money from merchandise sales. Chelsea are also saying, "Well, we you know, it made it more difficult for us to negotiate front of shirt and sleeve shirt deals." But the whale fin deal that they did sign for 22-23 is, by all accounts, a record deal. So, people say things, and then when you actually go in amongst the weeds and you start to dig out the numbers, sometimes the numbers don't back up the claims.
And is there a reason why this particular journalist picked out the Rudiger transfer as a specific example?
Well, it looks as if Rudiger had signed a pre-contract with, is it Real Madrid or Barcelona? Yeah, whoever it was, he'd signed a pre-contract before Chelsea's assets were frozen. So therefore, how can Chelsea use this as an excuse? Because the player was going to leave anyway.
Yeah, it will be one of those two clubs, Kieran. And let's leave it at that, because our listeners will love tweeting in to tell us which one it is and how we were wrong about the other one.
I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
We have a little run now, Kieran, of stories about grounds, which on the face of it, as Match of the Day would say, look like it's too good and too bad. So the first two, which look like good stories, are Oldham and Swindon.
Yes, I think that both of these are good. Oldham have been through some pretty tough times. Mm-hmm. The previous owners were erratic. There were issues with regards to part of the stadium because that was owned by a company called Brass Bank, which isn't a bank, by the way. But the new owners have come in, and they do seem to have galvanised the fan base. Everybody's now rowing in the same direction. So Oldham are now owned by a company called Groco 510 and another company, again owned by the club owners, called Groco 520, has taken over Brass Bank and has settled the vast majority of Brass Bank's outstanding mortgages. So we have all of the ground being owned by the same people, and I think that's got to be welcomed. So a bit of peace of mind for Oldham fans, and now they can start to focus on what's happening on the pitch. And yeah, Oldham fans travel in decent numbers in the National League, and they're getting some pretty decent crowds themselves as well. So I think that's a positive story. We've had issues again with previous owners of Swindon Town, but it looks like the new ownership team under Clem Morfuni, they have made an agreement to acquire the county ground for £2.3 million, of which he's putting up 50% of the money, and 50% is effectively coming from Fans Group. I think there was a fans trust which did receive a substantial amount of money, and that has gone into the purchase of that ground. This means that Swindon can plan with a degree of certainty, and we have said from day one, separation of football ground from football club isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it also isn't necessarily a good thing. So they've now got the purchase of the ground, which means that they are in a stronger position to move forward with more use of hospitality and commercial, development of individual areas, fan zones, whatever it's going to be. But it's the difference between owning a house and renting a house. You do have more flexibility as to what you can do with the assets.
Yeah, I'm really pleased, Kieran, to bring some good news to Oldham fans, and in particular, a very old and dear friend of mine, Chris England, who along with Nick Hancock does a wonderful pod called The Famous Sloping Pitch.
Yes.
And Chris has been an Oldham fan since he was a child. He's the same age as us. And every time I see Chris, I say, have you listened to The Price of Football yet? And I won't do his accent because he'll get cross. Although that's his default situation for most guys. I say, have you listened to The Price of Football? And he says, no, because there's only ever bad news about Oldham. To which I've said, that's not our fault, Chris. We're not doing that deliberately. But now I can phone him and say, well, you can at least listen to this one because we've got some very good news. And of course, because I'm so childish, because he won't listen to my pod, I won't listen to his. Right, which is shocking, I know, but even though I've been on it, I still won't listen to it. But two clubs, Kieran, and I think we should definitely deal with these separately. So Peterborough, going really well on the pitch, a brilliant result against Derby last weekend, but less good news about the ground.
Yes, this is a strange one, and we've just been saying in respect of Swindon that having football club and football ground under the same ownership has benefits. Well, that's not the case at Peterborough United. Peterborough United are tenants of the stadium,
yeah,
and the owners of the property asset have gone into receivership with themselves are in dispute with a company which appears to be connected to, and I might have misread this, appears to be connected with one of the owners of the club itself. So it all seems quite circular and messy. Darren McAntony, who is the very shy and retiring chairman of Peterborough United, he says, it's good news. There's nothing to worry about. The club isn't itself in chance of going into administration. He says, don't fret. What I would say with regards to this, this is something which we have been asked about in the past. Peterborough United last year launched the Posh Bond. Yep. Now, that was effectively a debenture deal where fans could loan money to the football club. They would get a rate of interest. They would get a bonus if Peterborough were promoted. But ultimately, it was an unsecured loan with the benefits and the negatives that go along with that. So again, sake of transparency, I bought into this. I always try to buy into football schemes if I can. I think it's then you get to see things through the eyes of different stakeholders within the game. So where does this leave the bondholders? Well, at present, it's full steam ahead because the loan arrangement is with Peterborough United Football Club. It's nothing to do with the owners of the stadium. What could happen in terms of the receivership of the ground? The receivers now have a responsibility to get the best possible deal. Peterborough have a long-term rental agreement. Could the owners sell the ground to a new landlord? Where does that leave the football club from a legal perspective? I don't know. But it makes you feel slightly more uneasy than you did before the owners went into receivership.
What happens, Kieran, if the owners of the ground who have gone into receivership, if the receivers get an offer which is the only one or the best one, but it depends on the ground's property value, if you like. So somebody says, we will buy this ground, but we are going to turf the club out and turn it into flats. How does that work in terms of, could that happen?
Well, I think you would have to look at the covenants that exist with regards to the right of use for the property assets.
Okay, right.
So what we could see here is the council say, well, you're not allowed to do that, and we're going to make it damn awkward if you do try to launch an appeal. So I would imagine that would be the approach that was taken by the local council. After all, there are, and I don't know whether this is applying to Peter, that we are coming up to local elections, and it would be fairly foolhardy for politicians of any one party to say, actually, we don't care what happens to the ground in future. We just want the highest price. So the receivers do have a duty that, it's part of their remit to try to maximise the price. I would imagine that there are some checks and balances in favour of the football club in terms of alternative use. So that's where the fingers would be crossed. But worst case scenario, if it is, if there are opportunities for either retail or domestic use for the plot of land, and speaking as somebody that supported a football club which is now occupied by Toys R Us, a shop in which I refuse to shop because that's what you should do as a football fan. You've got to check the small print.
Well, also you're a grown man, Kieran, so it's very unlikely for you to be shopping in any of that.
I'm not grown up, Kevin.
Fair point. Also, you and I, Kieran, have been to several away games at Peterborough, and their fans could be quite feisty. I wouldn't get on the wrong side of them.
Yes.
But now, this last story about grounds, Kieran, is confusing me slightly because it says here that West Ham are in the middle of a secret multi-million pound row with the owners of the London Stadium. And I did a bit of cursory research on this because I was intrigued by the word secret. And indeed, the two newspaper articles as well from major tabloids say it's a secret argument and goes on to explain exactly what the secret argument is about.
Yes. For people not familiar with what has happened at the London Stadium, It's a fantastic deal for West Ham. They, I think they are now paying, in order to have a, I think it's a 62,000 capacity stadium, they are paying around about £3.5 million a year in rent. But LLDC, who are the landlords, they have to provide the stewarding. They have to provide the corner flags. They've got, I think they're responsible for watering the pitch. They're responsible for all of the maintenance with regard to the ground. So it works out extremely well for West Ham. Now, LLDC, they are losing around about £20 million a year. And there has been reference, I think, that they've been budgeting for total losses of £200 million with regards to issues relating to the London Stadium. And the auditors have said, well, that £200 million, we think it could be a wee bit more. So that's the position. A few months ago, Daniel Kretinsky did buy a stake in West Ham, and it was felt at the time that the existing West Ham owners would not have to give any of the profits of that sale to LLDC because it wasn't a controlling interest. But we're not quite sure. We've not seen the small print. West Ham fans, and there's a lot of them who put out some absolutely fantastic information, the likes of Clara and Hugh and so on, and ex-WHU employee. They seem to have a lot of connections for those people that like to follow these things. According to the article, LLDC have incurred £7 million worth of legal fees with regards to this ongoing spat with West Ham. There is a case for saying that West Ham are waiting for these losses to get higher and higher and then going to come in and put in a ridiculously low ball figure to take the stadium off the hands of the council. And then West Ham, of course, will be able to have naming rights for the whole stadium and pick up all of those naming rights. At present, I think if there is naming rights for the London Stadium, LLDC get the first £4 million, and then there's a share arrangement between the football club and the landlord. So lots and lots of small print, lots and lots of work for the lawyers, hence LLDC, £7 million into the red with their legal costs. And I say their legal costs, I mean your legal costs, citizens of London, because ultimately it's coming out of the overall London budget.
You talk about the small print, Kieran. There's one bit I didn't understand in my admittedly cursory research, is that we've been led to believe in the last 4 or 5 years since the deal happened that it was a completely one-way deal, that West Ham got everything they wanted for a bargain price, LLDC were stitched up. And yet now we're being told that there's this clause, whereas with West Ham get a new owner, a new profit, LLDC get a share of that. Have I got that right?
Yes, you have. So I think the deal was that should, we know David Gold recently sadly passed away, David Gold and David Sullivan sell control of the football club within a set period of time, I've spoken to people who say they have been offered £800 million for the club historically, and they were looking for £1 billion, so that's why the deal didn't go through. Got no idea how the accuracy of that, but I think Karen Brady has put similar comments on her website, that a proportion of those profits would have gone to LLDC. But I think there is a deadline, and that deadline is either summer of 23 or summer of 24. So it was a timed deadline to stop Gold and Sullivan just saying, well, this is a fantastic deal for us. We're off ski straight away and sailing to the sunset. Okay. So therefore, they had to commit to being tenants themselves for a period of time. And then once the deadline is gone, they would not have to pass across any of the profits of sale.
There's been very high-profile news this week, Kieran, of sanctions against William Hill, which probably means that sanctions against another gambling company have gone under the radar a little bit, but it does have an impact on two big football clubs.
Yes. William Hill have been fined £19.1 million for a variety of issues in relation to the way that they conduct their business. There is a view that the gambling industry sees fines in exactly the same way as the water industry does. It's collateral damage, and it's cheaper than actually cleaning up their act. So therefore, they take the fines effectively as collateral damage. But in respect of football, Rangers and Middlesbrough's shirt sponsor 32 Red, they've been fined £7.1 million for social responsibility and anti-money laundering failures. The gambling companies are supposed to say, an awful lot of money seems to be coming into your account. Can you give us evidence of where it's coming from? Clearly, the gambling companies don't want to do that because they just want your money, because the chances are they're going to win. And remember, for the gambling industry, a problem gambler is not one who loses, it's one who wins. Yeah. And actually, they're very, very good at getting rid of those gamblers through reducing the limits on which they can gamble and so on. So if you talk to professional gamblers, they will start muttering about the behavior of the major gambling companies. So this is an awkward one because, you know, Rangers and Middlesbrough are not responsible for the failures of their front of shirt sponsor in respect of social responsibility and anti-money laundering failures. At the same time, all of those clubs, whether they're involved in crypto, which has failed, whether they're involved in gambling, where the companies, they do have an element of responsibility because they should be doing due diligence as to the social benefit and the social responsibility, because it's a bit like in real life. You to a certain extent, you're judged by the people with whom you keep company, and if you choose to not take too much notice of this, and there's a very good website called Josimar, by the way, which has also looked at one of Manchester City's betting sponsors or betting partners, and that doesn't look too clever either. It's happening again and again and again. People say, should we therefore get rid of gambling sponsors and crypto sponsors, or gambling sponsors certainly as far as football is concerned? And I must confess that my view is that that's not addressing the problem, because it's not creating behavioural changes, and the gambling industry will still spend a huge amount of marketing on TV, on radio, on perimeter. So just targeting football clubs themselves isn't addressing the much broader issue as to the fact that this country's got a bit of a gambling problem.
Yeah, one of the most frightening specific incidents of the William Hill fine was somebody who'd been flagged up as a problem gambler by William Hill, who was allowed to open another account in which he lost £23,000 in 20 minutes.
Yes.
Which is horrifying. But on a purely practical level, when it comes to Rangers and Middlesbrough, and the fact is that Rangers fans and Middlesbrough fans will quite rightly point out, we're only 2 years out of a pandemic. Money's short. You need to get sponsors. Gambling's not illegal. There are many, many clubs that have gambling sponsors. A fine of £7.1 million for 32 Red, would that have an impact on whether they can afford future sponsorship for Rangers and Middlesbrough?
No. This is a drop in the ocean.
Right, okay.
I understand where football comes from, and I do have a degree of sympathy. Although, there are clubs, we know Mark Palios at Tranmere, and he says, I just feel slightly sordid by partnering with such an organisation. So therefore, I don't want, and we ourselves, we both admit that we both gamble, but we won't have gambling sponsorship, and we won't have gambling advertising. Certainly in the UK, I know it's some of our overseas listeners say, it's creeping through on the when they down the show, but there's a limit to what we can do here. I think we are restricted to the UK, and that's the stand that we've taken. We're not doing this for virtue signalling, because I'll be honest, we both rather have the money, but I just don't feel that I can talk to people whose lives have been affected by gambling. And also, I've said my own family, we've had issues with gambling and resulting in members of the family ending up inside. And that's not a pleasant experience. So it's it's a sensitive issue. It's, in my view, the gambling industry has been the biggest beneficiary of the success of the Premier League, and yet it's not contributing as much as it should do. And that's why I keep saying that, you know, one of the ways of addressing the problems of grassroots football and the gap between the Premier League and the EFL is to say, given that the gambling industry is the biggest beneficiary of football in terms of the money that, right, and the gambling industry makes far more money out of football than football does itself.
Yeah.
Why not take the same approach as we have in horse racing and have a levy on every football bet? And that goes into grassroots football.
I don't know, Kieran, whether we have actually specifically told people this before, but we have turned down quite a large amount of money from one particular gambling company to sponsor us. And it in the end, it was an easy decision to make, but it kind of, there was a little part of me that went, oh, we'll find a way around this. We'll come up with some funny way to explain why we're being sponsored by these people. But, and also there's that other hypocrisy as well, because I say I don't gamble. I have the occasional bet. And it's exactly the same thing. It's just on a different end of the spectrum. Our final two stories, Kieran, will take us to some of our favourite people in the world, UEFA and FIFA. but before that, one of our favourite clubs has had a slight decrease in revenue, which is worth flagging up, but I don't think it's anything to worry about, is it?
This is Rotherham. They are normally in the Championship, one of the best run clubs, although Blackpool have done fantastically well in their first season. Rotherham's revenue fell by 20% last season because they dropped out of the Championship to League One, and that's another one of these cliff edges. It's just as bad. And we've got a yo-yo system between the Championship and League One, which is just as much of a problem in football as that of the Premier League and the Championship itself. Mm. And that's at one end of a club dropping out of the Championship. At the other end, it cost Bournemouth £55 million. They lost £55 million in getting back to the Premier League last season. They had to pay bonuses of £12 million, and their chief executive became the first. And this is where I got a little bit of sympathy for the Premier League, when you find that a chief executive of a club in the EFL Championship is being paid £2 million.
To UEFA, Kieran, and one of our favourite Spanish clubs, who Rudiger may or may not be playing for at the moment. Remember that bear we spoke about earlier who was going into the wood with his toilet roll under one arm and his paper? If he saw this headline on the back of his paper, he might do a bit of a double take, because it's not something we're used to.
Yes. Barcelona are going to be investigated by UEFA over payments made to a former referee's official. Now, we have spoken about this before. And a bit like how do you deal with issues of this nature, it tends to arise from the tax authority. Think about Al Capone. For all of the wrongness that he had within him, ultimately it was tax fraud that proved to be his wrongdoing. And I know that HMRC are investigating some clubs and some club owners at present, which will be interesting to see how that develops. But Barcelona domestically have been accused of corruption, fraudulent management, and falsification of business documents. Mm. Now, in the wrong'uns WhatsApp group, there's a little test that you have to do before you're allowed in. And if you ticked all three of those boxes, you're normally welcome with open arms. So UEFA do have the right to investigate from their perspective. And, you know, should these charges be upheld, then the tariff which is available to UEFA is pretty broad and could involve everything from points deductions, but it would be, wage freezes, salary caps, or the nuclear option is being banned from participation in the competition. Now, there's no evidence of referees being bribed. This would appear to be in respect of somebody whose responsibility it was to appoint referees. And we don't know the full detail of why Barcelona were making these payments. And the club itself are saying, it's just helping us with a bit of information about the referees, as to favourite car, where they like to go on holiday, favourite Spice Girl, this type of just so our players can have a bit of a chat with him.
Yeah, all the stuff you need to know before you kick off a Champions League final. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That's right.
Kieran, it's interesting because we have spoken the last couple of weeks about both the Premier League and the EFL rolling their sleeves up and getting stuck into the deep water, if you like. It's only sort of anecdotal evidence, but it occurs to me that UEFA have always been slightly reluctant to get involved with anything Barcelona related. So is this one of those things where they felt they have no option but to act because it looks so rum, shall we say?
I think UEFA are treading a very cautious path. Because Barcelona are still one of the three clubs, along with Juventus and Real Madrid, who are championing the Super League. It's a classic case of if you can get your revenge, get your revenge right. Yeah. And therefore, I can see why UEFA are just being a little bit cautious, not rushing into it. The best decisions are often the ones which are the most patient.
This last story, Kieran, about FIFA has unsettled me slightly because several times over the past few weeks, we've actually come quite close to saying that FIFA have almost done something right. And I'm slightly worried that we might be about to say the same thing. I'm hoping that I've misread this or that there is some kind of sinister ulterior motive. But at the moment, it does look like this is another feather in FIFA's cap, doesn't it?
Well,
great. You said,
yes,
well, that's a relief. Thank God.
What has happened is that FIFA have sanctioned a 70% increase in payments to clubs for release of players for the 2026 and the 2030 World Cup. So we're upping the figures to $355 million. So on the face of that, that seems good. But then you go, well, hold on. FIFA have also confirmed we've got the increased Club World Club. And this is a way, I think, of encouraging clubs to buy into FIFA, because the clubs initially said, well, hold on, this expanded Club World Cup, nobody's consulted us and nobody's consulted the players. But there does appear to be a bit of a love-ins taking place between Infantino and UEFA. And clearly UEFA is one of the most significant of the confederations. But you say, okay, 70% increase, that's great. But let's take a look at the 2026 World Cup. It's got 16 more teams, so it's increased in size by 50%. There's 40 more games. It's going to be a longer tournament as well. The FIFA Club World Cup is going to be a much longer tournament. We don't know where that's going to take place. We don't know about the impact that's going to have on domestic timetables as well, if it's going to involve. I think they said it's a maximum of three clubs from any one particular league. So if you've got Chelsea, Manchester United and Manchester City or Liverpool, whoever it's going to be, playing in this competition, and it's going to take 3 or 4 weeks in the middle of the season, that's going to cause huge disruption. The best way in football of getting people to stop being angry is to give them money. And that appears to be the approach taken by FIFA. The players keep saying, what are we going to do? I read a report recently that potentially some of the England players could end up having to play football for 51 weeks of the year.
Wow.
And I know people say, would have paid a lot of money. Well, yeah, but they're professional athletes. Mm. And and they also have families, and they're also entitled to a bit of downtime, as is everybody. If the Prime Minister and politicians and bankers and everybody else can go on holiday, why should footballers be treated different? Because Roger Federer used to do it in tennis. Tiger Woods used to do it with golf, and you didn't have people moaning about, "Oh, Tiger Woods has gone away for a couple of weeks. Isn't it an absolute disgrace?"
I quite like the idea of Harry Kane and Raheem Sterling going, hang on a second, Kieran Maguire gets a week off. We're not working harder than he is.
I don't.
You don't? No, yes, I faltered halfway through that sentence. tomorrow, Kieran, we have one of our semi-regular interviews. It's with Tom Montgomery, director of Llandudno Football Club, and it's a really, really interesting one. It's well worth a listen.
Absolutely.
In the meantime, thank you to everyone who's listening to this one, and thank you to everyone who's donated to the pod via our Patreon page. If you'd like to join them and make a small monthly contribution to the pod, please go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. And if you have a question you'd like answered on the show, email us at questions@priceoffootball.com. And in the meantime, I shall hand you over to Mr. Kieran Maguire for his customary farewell.
Well, thank you to everybody who supported us via Patreon. And if you'd like to make a small monthly contribution to the podcast, go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. And if you'd like a question answered on the show, probably in 2025, looking at our inbox, email us at questions@priceoffootball.com. And if you want to support the show in any other way, go onto that app and give us a review. And somebody gave us a one-star review this week, Kevin.
Did they?
Said they were... there were too many jibes about Brighton. I'm going, I think at least 50% of the presenters were probably saying there's not enough.
There was a Scottish comedian many years ago who got a one-star review from the Scotsman, and ooh, all over town on his poster plastered words, "A star, the Scotsman," which the Scotsman got really cross about and said, no, we gave you one star. So he plastered all over his poster, still, A star.
Brilliant. The Price of Football. Price of Football.